What started as a war on woke has become a war on truth and a tool to dismantle voting rights and other rights. The lie that the 2020 election was stolen has fueled some 300 voter suppression bills across the country. States are purging voter rolls, requiring strict ID matches, making it difficult and hard to register to vote. Right here in Ohio, which I shared with you last night, was once the citadel of abolitionism and the anti-slavery movement. In the early days of this nation, two proposed laws threatened to erect new barriers on Election Day. And unlike past times when courts stood as a check, we now are beginning to see, particularly at the level of the Supreme Court, a complete collapse of those constitutional guardrails. The system meant to protect democracy is being used to dismantle it. Simply put, this is a state of emergency. This year's State of Black America, I think, speaks, yes, to the state of emergency for Black America, but I think it speaks to something much broader and much larger, and that is the state of emergency for the nation at large, the state of emergency for American democracy. Now, we will not go away quietly. The civil rights community and people of goodwill and people who have passion and people who love this nation are fighting back, some with lawsuits that have been filed, some with protests, some with legislative advocacy, some with selective buying campaigns. We join with others in suing to overturn these racially motivated anti-diversity executive orders. And also, we are leaning in what we do on the D3 framework: defend democracy, demand diversity, and defeat poverty. Earlier this year, at the beginning of the year, as these executive orders came down, we convened a historic roundtable of some 20 organizations, civil rights and social justice organizations. Who was in the room? Certainly the African American civil rights legacy organizations were in the room. Prominent Latino organizations were in the room. Prominent Asian American organizations were in the room. The HRC, which represents the LGBTQ community, was in the room. Several Jewish organizations were in the room. The Arab American organization was in the room. We built a round table, which was multicultural, to focus on diversity and to uplift all that is good and to try to build the broadest coalition to fight. We communicated with the White House. We communicated with the public, demonstrating that diversity, equity, inclusion is not just good policy, it's good economics. It's vital to our democracy. Some get caught in the nomenclature of diversity, equity, and inclusion. What does it really mean? I encourage everyone to go back to the root. The root is the principle of equal opportunity. The root is the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Whether it's diversity, equity, and inclusion, whether it's affirmative action, whether it's equal employment opportunity, all of these are mere implementation strategies, implementation steps, implementation programs to make the promise of equal opportunity real in every way and in every measure. And so we include in this year's State of Black America report a section on how diversity, equity, inclusion help to expand voting rights, civic engagement, and economic participation. The clear through line from the Civil Rights Act to the outlawing of employment discrimination to increase economic opportunity and rising turnout is one of the hallmarks of the progress of the second half of the 20th century. As I've said before, we're heirs to that legacy. We're progenitors of that legacy. We are a generation that had an opportunity to sit in seats, go through doors, work together in ways unimagined 100 years ago. Candidates are stepping into leadership strengthening their communities, and creating a more prosperous America for all. That's what's at stake. This is not about taking opportunities away from anyone. It's about expanding the table. It's about expanding the table of opportunity. We have almost a $30 trillion economy in this nation. And I believe that with a $30 trillion economy, there's a seat at the table for everyone. We are about protecting an America that is fair and free, where all of us, regardless of race, creed, color, religion, can survive. The report doesn't just document the threats. We celebrate the resistance. In classrooms, courtrooms, boardrooms, state houses, city halls, in big cities and small towns, in community-based organizations, in faith-based organizations, a new generation is rising to defend our progress and demand more. This work is hard. This work is going to take a long time. This work is going to require our ongoing commitment. But we know that this arc doesn't bend towards justice on its own. We must bend it. We must bend it with strength and with will. This is our moment as a generation. And we must not allow hate, fear, or division to define us. We were made for this moment, and indeed we will meet it together. The State of Black America comments this year on the state of the nation. And I want to give you a few warning signals from information over the last just several weeks. For the first time in a long time, we see black unemployment rising while white unemployment is falling. In March of this year and in April of this year, a record number, and this is a regrettable number, a record number of African-American women found their ways to the unemployment lines. We're beginning to see the real, demonstrable statistical impact on these policies of division. And we've got to be aware that this is not just a show we're watching on television. This is not just a movie that we're going to rate and observe. It's not a horror flick. It's not a melodrama. It is real, and it is affecting all of us. So after this, we're going to have a great panel discussion led by Ed Gordon with some important thought leaders to talk more about the state of Black America and the state of the nation. And I'm grateful for all of them for being with us today. A few participants could not make it because of flight challenges due to the weather on the East Coast, but I'm happy that they are here with us today. Suffice it to say that almost 50 years ago, when Vernon Jordan released the first version of the State of Black America, it's because he was confronted with an administration at that time, the Ford administration, which had completely ignored the difficult challenges that Black America faced. His response to it was to promulgate his own report with its own critique and its own recommendations. We stand in that spirit today with a report that is unapologetic in defining all of the challenges that we face, but is also constructive in making suggestions and recommendations on how to go forward. So thank you all very much. That's a summary of the State of Black America. Please read it. Please use it. Please use it as an instrument to inspire debate and discussion wherever you are. So thank you very much. I turn it back to Rhonda. Once again, good morning.
And now we prepare for our next segment of our opening plenary. We are so happy to have with us to lead the conversation Emmy Award-winning journalist Ed Gordon. Known for his stellar conversations with newsmakers across politics, entertainment, and sports, he serves as president of Ed Gordon Media, a multi-service production company. He is a CBS News contributor, a special correspondent for the BET CBS News program, America in Black. He's also the author of the best-selling book, Conversations in Black. He also hosts the nationally syndicated radio program, Weekend with Ed Gordon. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome none other than Ed Gordon.
Good morning. I know 8 people have said it. Good morning. All right. Listen, we are going to get right into this as time is going to move by a lot quicker than we would imagine. You've already heard where we sit in our time and the importance of us moving forward. So let me bring out 3 women who have been on the front line of this fight for many, many years. We will also have an opportunity for you to ask some questions. But as our time is short today, I would ask that you keep it at a question rather than a comment. You can hold your comments when we leave the room. You can speak all you want in the hallway. But we would ask you to keep your questions brief, and we will go from there. First, let me introduce Melanie L. Campbell, President and CEO of the National Coalition on Black Civic Participation and conveyor of the Black Women's Roundtable. She is recognized as one of the hardest working servants in today's civil rights, women's rights, and social justice movement. Melanie recently celebrated 25 years of service with the National Coalition and has served as an advisor to U.S. presidents, congressional members, and many others on critical issues impacting Black America. She served as the featured writer for the National Urban League State of Black America and is regularly featured in a wide range of media outlets. Please welcome Melanie Campbell. Next, Maya Wiley, President and CEO of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. Attorney Wiley is a nationally respected civil rights attorney who has litigated cases for the ACLU, NAACP Legal Defense Fund, and the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York. She has been a program curator in philanthropy, nonprofit, government, and higher education, and co-founder of the Center for Social Inclusion, now part of the Raise Forward and National Policy Strategy organizations working to end structural racism. Please welcome Maya Wiley. And finally, Professor Kimberly Crenshaw, co-founder and executive director of the African American Policy Forum. Professor Crenshaw is a prominent American legal scholar and civil rights advocate, best known for developing the concept of intersectionality. She is a professor at UCLA School of Law and Columbia Law School, specializing in race and gender issues. She is also the co-founder and executive director of the African American Policy Forum. Please welcome Kimberly Crenshaw. Ladies, so good to see you all, and it is not an understatement to say that all of you have been on the front lines of this fight for a long time, because we should note that this is not a new fight. It has been ongoing for decades now. But Melanie, if I may start with you, there is a change, though, in this fight now. It is perhaps, if we can allow for this, more desperate than we've seen in many, many years. Talk to us about where we sit today, because Mark mentioned the word rhetoric. Sometimes people fall asleep when they hear too much rhetoric. Talk to them about why, Melanie, we have to understand how desperate these times are.
Well, first of all, thank you. And Ed, I always have to give you the shout out. The first time I got before a public audience was in 1995 in Atlanta, Georgia, with SCLC convention, and I froze on stage. So he got me through that moment. And then, of course, he's going to start with me, right? But so I don't freeze. Well, you know, the reality was different, I would say, in answering that question about, like, we are still making many gains. But what's different? I'm going to use and talk about this in the back. What's different about this movement, right? We have just heard the mayor of Cleveland, right? But the mayor of Newark was arrested for doing his job. A congresswoman was arrested. A U.S. senator was attempted to be arrested in California. So we're in a different time. I'm a native Floridian. Any Floridians in the house, right? You know, we know the Everglades. You're putting people in supposedly detention centers. A congresswoman from Miami called it. She's Jewish, and she said it's not detention. It's It's concentration camps. So we are living in a different time. With that backdrop, right? And so it calls for us to really, really dissect that and how we ask people like me, who are not afraid to get arrested. If the senator gets arrested, or congressman or mayor gets arrested in civil disobedience, what does that do for somebody like me, or somebody who's just that average person who shows up to a protest? So it's different, right? But we also can't let fear block us, but we have to be strategic. We can't put everything, I can't tell you everything we're doing like I used to, right? And so we have to think about how we go about this time when we are really at an existential threat on the very fabric of what this nation is supposed to be about, which is a democracy. So I'll stop there and add.
Maya, we're all on a weekly call, and then we share information on a thread. And we had some weeks back Stacey Abrams address us about her concern about autocracy and the idea of it not being as far away as many people think. Give us a sense of, again, I'm just trying to kind of...
I mean, we're here, y'all. Mm-hmm. We are here in what is called competitive authoritarianism. That is just the fast track to autocracy by a different name. And we have to acknowledge it.
Trump's an easy target in one way. He makes himself very easy. But there are other Trumps, someone like a Stephen Miller, as a for instance, mm-hmm. who may be as dangerous, if not more so, Donald Trump. What has to be done to make sure that these people are not only known to all of us, but combating what they're putting out there?
I'm so glad, Ed, that you raised that question. I'm glad for all that you do. And I'm really proud to be here with my sister leaders because these two women have been teaching me and fighting for so long. And we are going to win because we have them in the fight. Your point is right. Donald Trump is president of the United States. Trumpism is running the country.
That's right.
Trumpism is something that predated Donald Trump. So what I'm calling Trumpism, some call it MAGA, but I think the labels are a problem in the sense that what we are really seeing is a long and concerted and unbroken effort from white supremacists to ensure that we go back to a period before our victory that was making this country one that was starting to live up to its actual ideas of democracy. Its actual, you heard President Morial say, its actual ideals of diversity, equity, inclusion, accessibility. We should never forget accessibility. And so when we saw the Project 2025 playbook, how many of you know Project 2025? All right, when a lot of us read that playbook, we were like, oh, they're saying the quiet part out loud now. Mm-hmm. They're saying the part that they've been saying for 40 years out loud now. They've been saying they want to end the Department of Public Education, which we fought for as a civil rights community. They're saying they want to make gender, make the idea of what it is to be a woman, what they define it as. And they're not just talking about transgender. They're talking about roles. They literally say in Project 2025 that they do not, that if women are getting paid less, it's because they want to stay home. No, and y'all know because we've been working for generations. Black women working all, we were looking for the right to sit home.
That's right.
Okay. But I am only saying, has that worked out for us as well as we wanted? But my point is they're trying to rationalize the unfairness. They're trying to rationalize the discrimination. They're trying to rationalize dismantling government that's in tension is supposed to help us all be able to solve the problems our communities have. Doesn't mean we have to agree. And that's not about partisan politics, by the way. That's not about Democrat, Republican. That's about an extremist ideology that is now playing out in government, and it is playing out in our courts. And the only way we confront that is the way every single country that has, and the way that we have, because as black people, we know what totalitarianism looks like. We know what authoritarianism looks like. Mm-hmm. We know what it means to say we have all competitive authoritarianism means is it is authoritarian, but there's still elections. They rigged the rules, but the elections still happen. Mm-hmm. Right now, we are confronting using the federal government to disenfranchise over 20 million legal voters by demanding a birth certificate or a passport for federal elections. Why do I use that particular example? That is not about free and fair elections. That is about controlling decisions, including who we decide leads us, by just simply blocking people's access to the ballot box. That comes to one other point I want to connect it to, which we shouldn't forget. Right now, the National Education Association, how many of you know NEA? Okay? How many of you are educators? Well, you all do an education. National Education Association is the nation's oldest and largest. I mean, it's literally a union that has existed of educators fighting for public education and chartered by Congress. Because they have opposed closing Department of Education, because they have opposed slashing programs about learning about how to teach better, because they have opposed the cuts to grants and the cuts to Title I funds to public schools that are coming, because they have done what they're supposed to do in advocating for their 3 million members and their over 14,000 communities, education communities. That's us. That's our kids. That's our schools. That's our children. Because they've done that, there is now an effort to end them mm-hmm. and their ability to advocate. This is happening across the board. So every time we're talking about what is really happening, it is happening now by not only trying to silence us, it's not just trying to make us afraid, it's actually coming for our power. Yes. It's coming for our very existence of our legal institutions. It's coming for the very ability of our communities to make demands of government when extremists don't like our demands.
Right. Yeah. Yes.
So what do we do? We make our demands. We make them. We make them loud. We talk about who we are. We talk about what we need. We talk about what we want to read. And we talk about the fact that you are not going to come for our institutions or our communities because we are your bosses.
Mm-hmm. Let me take that point, Kimberly, because you've had this clarion call for a long time. I think you were ahead of the curve in trying to kind of ring that bell and tell people what was going on. But part of the issue for me, and I say this when I look at my industry, which really has folded all of this and
absolutely.
Has done nothing to help curb the idea of them defining terms and telling us what is when we know it isn't. How do we make sure that we muscle up and change that? They co-opted defund the police. They co-opted DEI. They co-opted affirmative action years
critical
back.
Critical race theory, intersectionality. It goes on and on and on. First of all, let me thank Mark for inviting me to come to my hometown. Basically, I grew up in Canton, about 60 miles from here, so it's really great to be home. But yeah, let me pick that up and bring the particular condition of this possibility in it that speaks most directly to us, and that is the anti-blackness that is at the core of the effort to destroy our democracy, and the fact that we are the sort of the first community to experience the thing that's going to happen to everybody else. And that is a reflection of a long, long-standing historical reality that anti-blackness, I like to paraphrase Rick James, is a terrible drug because it makes people lean into policies and practices that actually undermine their own interests, but because it pushes us down first and more, they think it's the thing to do. So we can see this going all the way back to the Civil War. The vast majority of white folks who fought to maintain slavery didn't own slaves, didn't even benefit from it. But they were willing to give up their lives for it. Why? Because of anti-blackness, because of the ideology that as long as I've got my foot on your throat, I'm doing okay. We're seeing this play out even today in the big bad bill in which millions upon millions of people will lose fundamental rights and access. But because they believe that this is essential to making America great again, which is a racial project, because America was never great back in segregation, they are willing to adopt that, right? So this is a fundamental dynamic that has repeated itself over and over and over again across history. So here's the question for us. Because we know this playbook, and I'll say this again from my folks in Ohio, y'all know that I come from the football Hall of Fame town. Most of my analogies are football. Here's an analogy. People hold on to their playbooks because they think that if the other side knows the play, they'll be able to get ahead of it. Many of us thought that if we tell people about Project 2025, that is the playbook for dismantling our democracy, we'll be able to get ahead of it. Turns out, not so much. Being told exactly what they are going to do to dismantle our democracy didn't work. My sense is the reason why is that they didn't think they'd be harmed by it. They thought we were the ones that would be harmed by it. This is the condition of this possibility that we have to begin to address. So to go to your point, Ed, for years we have been arguing not just with the MAGA folks, because at least they're on brand. They know mm-hmm. what they're doing. Mm-hmm. The argument is with our own folks who were willing to say, oh, they're going after CRT. That's not me. I'm going in the other direction. Oh, they're going after 1619. I didn't really read that. I'm going in the other direction. Now, oh, they're going after DEI. I actually happen to be the director of DEI in my company. Or I actually happen to be someone who got a job because of expanding recruitment. Now it is clear that we cannot pivot away from a racist attack, because what they're attacking is not the particular project or the particular group. They're attacking the entire infrastructure. So what we're looking at now is a paradigm shift away from the civil rights consensus, away from what most people think when they hear we shall overcome, away from what we do every year that we celebrate Martin Luther King. It's a paradigm shift. It's a repudiation of that entire project. Now, the question is, what do we call this? I love the idea of competitive authoritarianism. I like reminding people of what Langston Hughes said. He said, you don't have to tell the Negro about fascism. We know what fascism is. That is what white supremacy has always been. It is fascism. But we don't call it that. Our country doesn't call it that. Why? Because that happened to black people, right? The same thing happening somewhere else in Europe, that's a problem to people. They worry about that. Mm-hmm. So I get in debates all the time with some of my colleagues when I say we're in a fascist regime. They're like, oh, not so much. And they list all the things that happen in Europe. That's telling me that in their view, they don't have to worry until the stuff in Europe happens to them. They're not thinking about the things that have happened to us since we arrived here. So that's the history that we have to bring back. So I'll end with this. You've been asking what we should do. One of the clearest things is when they try to take away our memory, when they try to take away our literacy, our ability to read, to speak the truth as we see it, know it, and experience it. It is a way to legitimize racial hierarchy and inequality. If you can't talk about what's wrong, if you can't talk about the history of how we got here, if you can't advocate for the kind of policies that are necessary in order to redress that, then you've basically created a regime in which you have massive amounts of inequality that will grow, and we are unable to actually speak to it and demand any kind of recompense. That's what the project is right now. And that's why we have to do
everything possible to protect our history, to protect our museums, to protect our books, to protect our knowledge, to protect our ideas, to protect our memory, because that's where our strength is. My good friend, Barbara Arnwine, who today is doing a massive effort to protect the right to vote, the John Lewis Day of Action, always says when I call her up and I'm whining about, you know, they're coming after critical race theory, I can't get anybody to get involved, she says, look, Kim, no dog barks at parked cars. Nobody tries to steal something that isn't valuable. So if they're trying to come after our history, our books, our institutions, it's because it's valuable.
That's right.
And we have to do everything to protect it.
Let me continue the sports analogy. Melanie, you and I were talking about this backstage. The idea that we also have to look in the mirror and find out why we landed where we are. There is a sense of, if you think about a sporting event, a good coach will look at the game and say, I've got to shift right at halftime. What I thought was going to work isn't working. I need to make some change. Give me a sense of what you want us to do in terms of change.
Well, I would say it this way. Look at your neighbor. Say, you the leader you're looking for. Look at your other neighbor. You're the leader you're looking for. Everybody in here has a role to play in this. And I mentioned, Ed, you know, folks said, well, when are y'all going to go out here and, you know, show up and get locked up? I brought that up because it is part of a strategy, direct action, but you have to be strategic about that in a different way right now. As I'm not doing that right now. That's not the playbook right now. But what is the playbook is when you talked about it, Kim, when you had your Freedom to Learn week, where we spent a whole week where we focused on just that. Focus on the fact that if we're going to protect our own history, what does that look like? Right? That means we're not going into, we spent that whole week, not just a day, a whole week where you had us actively engaged in what do we do about Freedom to Learn and protecting our history. Part of that was in the streets. Part of that was social media, all the kinds of things. Part of that is writing a check to the African American Museum or the museum in your own community. Because in Washington, D.C., it's not just the big museum that everybody sees. It's the Anacostia Museum, right? It's the museums in any town. Think about all the things that are in your community. So if you want to save black history and history, save it where you are. And that will bubble up. Right? One of the other things, you know what I was saying? How are we going to deal with these elections? Right? And the realities of, I still believe that is still part of the strategy that we have to utilize. And with young people, I've been active, and I mentioned things that are happening that as a leader, you can also follow, right? So going and being, many of us, part of the Say the People Power Tour, Angela Rye and some of the younger leaders, being a part of the solution, right? And I know there's a lot of folks in here from various backgrounds, and I'm going to say this too, and this is no disrespect, but to the corporate leadership, we need y'all to step up, right? Why do we need you to step up? There is no such thing as a free market society without a democracy. Mm-hmm. And so if corporate America doesn't step up in the ways that you can, and understanding that there's no appeasing a dictator.
Right.
It's only you just get put over here, oh, so I got you, so you're over here. We got solution people still fighting over here. So if enough of these folks over here end up over here, we're done. Mm-hmm. Our children's children, will live in a whole different country. We're there. Mm. Stacey Abrams was my intern when she was in Atlanta at Spelman College, right? When I worked for Maynard Jackson. Understanding that everybody has a role to play in this. And I don't have all the solutions. Because if we look at our civil rights history in this country, we've had our lives threatened. But I've never been in a position where if I get locked up, you could send me to El Salvador or Sudan, right? Or for home folks in Florida or down in those damn doggone Everglades. It's a real thing. And when we think about, oh, it's just the immigrant people. Of the Native Americans, we all came here on slave ships, so we came over here, right, looking for a better day. We're all immigrants in that sense, right? These things aren't being built just, they are attacking the Latino community, the Haitian community, and it's coming for any of us. If you can get locked up on the street, think about it. Somebody walks up to you with a mask on, no badge, and snatches you and puts you in a car. What you gonna do? Who you gonna call? Mm. Ghostbusters? So, understand that I start where I ended. What are you gonna do? I know what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna keep fighting. But if enough of us, this is the day that John Lewis went to be an ancestor, July 17th, 2020. Think about what's happened in the last 5 years. And you have to ask yourself, we have to ask ourselves, what am I doing that will impact when I'm no longer on this earth? Because that's the moment we're in. If we learn from history, understanding this country, we talk about this all the time. If you think about the first Reconstruction, right? There was backlash after slavery ended. Major backlash. And you had Jim Crow. You think about the second Reconstruction. What was that, the 50s and 60s? We got the 64 Civil Rights Act, the 65 Voting Rights Act, the 68 Fair Housing Act. Backlash. Audacity to elect a black man. Audacity to put a black and South Asian woman in office and almost had a woman as president. Backlash. The backlash can last 70 years. How many of us think we're going to be here in 70 years? So the fight we have... Unless you're a baby, right? The fight we have is beyond our time on this earth. And so we have to understand we're in that moment. We fight back for another day, but we're fighting for the future that we won't see.
Maya. Yes. Maya, let me ask you this as relates to singular focus, because I think a lot of times there's so much going on. We get lost in the malaise of all that is hitting us. But I'd like you to talk about, particularly Mark talked about voter suppression, how important midterms are.
Yes.
We need to be looking at that immediately.
Maya? That was a Maya question.
Well, Melanie obviously is one of our critical leaders on voter participation. So what she said. look, I also Kimberly said this as well. What we're talking about, our singular focus needs to be power. Mm-hmm. Our singular focus needs to be
power.
Our singular focus needs to be
power.
What is our power? Our power is showing up and making demands. And we do that when we show up at the ballot box. Every time we show up at the ballot box, we're making a demand. Because nobody's voting just for a person. They're voting for what that person is saying they're going to do. Mm-hmm. The midterms are critically important for this reason, right? For all the things we've been talking about. There's no single issue here because nobody lives a single issue life. Mm-hmm. That's what we just heard broken down. Mm-hmm. And what we are seeing is an attack on all of it. That is also what we're saying. The critical thing I think we have to think about is people often do not show up to vote. And we don't tell people who to vote for. We're nonpartisan. We do talk about what to vote about. Mm-hmm. And we're entering a period right now where literally people, some of whom voted for what we're experiencing right now, who are going to get seriously harmed. Because literally 17 million people are going to stop being able to see a doctor when they're sick because of what just happened with reconciliation. Literally, we're going to see kids with disabilities in schools who are not going to get services. Literally, we're going to start seeing classrooms become overcrowded. Literally, we're going to see hunger go up
and a new form of indentured servitude called being forced to work for a check for your Medicaid. So the reason I'm saying all these things is because people will show up about the power to change those things when we're making clear what things they're going to have to change because they're going to harm them. And I can't stress that enough because everything we've all said is true. And everything we've said, 60% of black children are on Medicaid. Mm-hmm. 60%. This isn't us issue, but it's also the opportunity to make sure they know, you know, when they come for us, they're coming for you. Mm-hmm. Because you on Medicaid too. Mm-hmm. Because your kids are on Medicaid too, and because your kids have learning disabilities too.
It's in most rural communities.
Hospitals are going to close in low-income black. White communities. So my point is it's an us. We can be explicit about race, as we're also being explicit about it's all of us. And we need to do that around power, and we need to recognize that they're trying to tell people they can't vote people out or in who are going to make sure they can see a doctor when they're sick or get learning and be able to learn their history.
I want to forward, but before I ask Kimberly to follow up on that, I want to tell folks that we have microphones on either side of these outside aisles. No microphone in the middle aisle, so the outside aisles, I would ask that you line up, but if you see three or four people already there, kind of just take a seat and wait till that line dies down. We don't want anybody hitting the floor. I heard y'all was out late last night, so just do what you can. And again, please remember we're going to ask you for a brief question. Kimberly, let me ask you to kind of piggyback on what Maya said, and for me it is also about accountability to leadership. And accountability to those we put in office. Often for me, I think people think the last day of your participation politically is election day.
That's right. That's
and
right.
Really, that should be day one for day you. One. Give me a sense of how that paradigm shift should happen.
Yeah. And let me also build on the power question. What worries me the most these days is there seems to be a widespread consensus. It's unspoken, but you see it in the agendas that are set, that the one condition that has made so much of this possible, our historic anti-blackness, is the thing that's not going to be mentioned. So we get allies who have movements and marches, and they have a whole list of issues to bring people out. But if you look at it from the perspective of the black community, you don't see our issues really listed in the progressive coalition. Some of the biggest fights that I've had recently are with some of our allies who will say, well, you know what, we need to go with the issues that most people are prepared to hit the streets on. We need to go with the issues that most people are on the same page. And, of course, we all know that questions of affirmative action, DEI, anti-black policing, that was 2020. That's not 2025. Every time that happens, every time we're erased, every time we're asked to show up and people are not showing up, that's a loss of power. That means the power that we have aggregated, accumulated, created since the 1950s is constantly being drained. If you see the civil rights community as drawing down on an account, a bank account, of moral imperative to address inequality, we have to acknowledge the fact that the bank account is about dry right now. That is a serious circumstance, because even when we're able to take back Congress in the midterms, the understanding is still going to be there that there is not a moral mandate anymore to deal with these huge racial disparities. That is going to be a window that is going to be open to deal with the anger that's going to come from the millions upon millions of people, as you know, my sisters have both said, who are going to be suffering. As long as our administration, as long as the plutocrats know that if they can point the finger, like Charles Stewart did many, many years ago, killed his own wife and child and blamed it on black people, everybody went after them, that's exactly what's going to happen now. So we have to be prepared to demand accountability, not just from our elected officials, but yes, from our elected officials, but also from our allies. So when we see that we are not part of the agenda, when we see the questions about redlining and wealth disparity and health disparity that impact Black people, Black women, Black children not being mentioned, then that's a moment for us to fight, even if it's in the room of allies. That's the accountability that our future generation demands from us. So I completely agree with Melanie, who reminds us that, yes, we're in a retrenchment moment, right? We had 3 good months of people saying, yes, we're going to deal with racism. Yes, Black people, we're going to deal with you. 3 months.
That's right.
And now we've had 5 years of retrenchment. We had 10 years of Reconstruction. We had 70 years of retrenchment. So the cycles are happening quicker. The retrenchment is deeper. So if we think about what's happening now and playing it forward, we're probably looking at another 70, 80 years of retrenchment unless we don't get out there right now and fight it with everything we've got. So I'll end with this. What you all are doing here is exactly what you have to encourage other people to do. We cannot fight this on our phones.
Mm-hmm. That's it.
Right. The civil rights movement wasn't phoned in. People put their bodies where the issue was. We were able to build community and connection. You all are in the front lines of that, and everybody needs to bring 10 more people into that. That's what we're going to need to fight.
And we should note 2 things, because there will be younger people who will say, well, that's a generational thing. No one is saying that the phone isn't important and that there isn't movement toward it. It just can't be the singular thing that I liked it and I did what I needed to do. We have to utilize the technology, but we also have to use muscle, real muscle, to get a movement. The other thing we need to make sure that we understand is there are fights that have been going on generationally that are still going on. Take a look at redistricting and redrawing lines. Texas is doing that as we speak. And so it's very important to make sure that some of the things that we thought we already fought, those battlegrounds are still active and we still need to be there. All right, let me turn our attention to the audience. And again, please remember a quick question. So I'll start on my left and we'll ask you to tell us where you're from, your name, and then give us your question.
Hi, my name is Walt Dixon from Syracuse, New York.
Syracuse.
I really want to get, this is my therapy for a moment, is that we ran a sister named Sarah Nones for mayor in Syracuse against the Democrat establishment, and we won by 40 percentage points. The reason I say it in that way, because she wants to run, she talks like you. She's a younger woman, but she talks like you ladies, is that we recognize that Black men are not on in the battlefield, younger or old, in Syracuse, the disparity, and if we won an election, we feel that we're not going to be a part of it. And we're making the hard discussions about the unions portraying this country. We don't talk about union membership, not union leadership. Mm-hmm. That's got to be out there. And 2, we have to, how do we introduce young and older Black men that their role is vital and important? If not, we don't get that right. And force state government to invest in these communities, not 60 days before election, a year from today for the future. And we're not having those conversations. Thank you.
Yeah. You ran for mayor. So.
Well, and I was born in Syracuse. So hello. This is a very critical issue and point. And I think, and you've actually already, you answered the question. Because the reality is, it's if we are not talking to and listening, mostly listening. When I say talking to, I mean listening. To what our young Black men are saying, we will not be building power with them. Because power isn't built on telling people what they want or need. It's built on listening to them and working with them on what they want and need. And, you know, I think we're seeing that in real time in our politics in many different ways, and it's the brokenness where we're not saying, and some Black men, let's be clear, not most, but some Black men showed up and voted against what I would argue are our community's interests, including their own. But if you listen, what they were saying is, I'm sick and tired of people thinking government works for me.
Right.
and just telling me what they're going to tinker with, and I want someone who's going to blow it up. But what we have to do is listen to, but and to do what? What is it that we're supposed to be? And I think we know a lot. Often we won't be surprised by what we hear, because it's often jobs. It's often an actual future. It's often something real about being able to take care of oneself and have a future. But I'm saying that because I think we have to own that we don't do that enough, and therefore create and build their power with them, not by telling them what we want them to do.
All right. Yes.
Good morning. Good morning. Thank you for being here. Antonio White, 480 Advisors, former U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary for the U.S. Treasury and former Executive Leader for the Federal Housing Finance Agency. From D.C., but born and raised right here in Cleveland in the 90s in Kinsman. So I'm not going back. I'm an optimist. So I guess my question to you is what is our state and local strategy? For the last 4 years, Republicans have quietly done a grapevine strategy. And so I feel like we are always downstream. So what can we do to be upstream? What are we doing for the next 4 years between now and 2028 to have our own state and local strategy? And then the second question is, I did the racial equity audit for Treasury, and we audited all of the corporations and we read all of their commitments. How are we raising the threshold on how we determine the access we provide for corporations who find it very easily to pull away from our causes? And how do we make sure that we extract what we need from them when they come to our spaces as well? So that's my question. Thank you.
The second question is how we spend our money. Just straight up. I did spend a time in corporate America. If you're a for-profit venture, then it's about the profit and the bottom line. How we spend our money and weigh in. So that's my short answer to that. And we're seeing that without calling names and being respectful of space, we do that. And we have to do more of that, right? When it comes to what we do the next 4 years, I'll say the next five, and I'll start with decennial census. We're talking about power, and we have a government that's not going to. And I know, because I work partner with the Urban League, shout out to Mark, we co-chair the Black Census Roundtable, and we are talking all consistently. But that has to be part of a long-term. We have to look at the power dynamic. Really, we need to look at it beyond five. We need to look at it with a 30, 20, you know, 10, 5 lens, and develop the kind of strategies that move that. What's happening, what we already know from the last decennial census, is that we've moved south, nothing against Ohio, right? But there are states that we know right now that are likely to gain seats. That trickles down to your state legislatures as well, right? And how lines are drawn, it gets down into the weeds. But if we have to power map that political map for wherever you are, right? We are winning in mayor's races. We have a mayor right here, right? But we also know that the federal government impacts what that local mayor could do. As I mentioned, I worked for Maynard Jackson. I was in a local, powerful, as we all know, those who know Maynard Jackson's history, of how he was able to do. But we still had to deal with what happened with the federal government. And so we have to deal with that and lay out those kinds of mapping. We have to get down to the granular. We hosted a Southern Regional convening back in June that you all participated in various ways. Why? Because we need to get in a room. And I say, we can do what we can do in conferences, but we have to go down to the granular and see where the power dynamic. Florida likely to gain a congressional seat. Texas likely to gain. Where are the power? California's going to lose some districts. So we have to look at that power map on that political spectrum and really get it all the way down to the local. We're winning. You go to a local town, if we've got the numbers, we're going to win the local elections. But the systemic dismantling of the federal government, right, will have an impact on what that local mayor or city council will be able to do.
Can we add on to that? Because this is, and I agree with everything Melanie has said, but I want to note something else, which is not all corporations are susceptible to how we spend our money. And if we're thinking about the big tech firms right now and we're watching how they're behaving, which is all the fights we did to say to tech companies like Facebook, like I'll go down the list, Twitter, like YouTube, about mis- and disinformation in election cycles and how they're moderating, they have removed those protections. Sometimes they weren't even good enough before they removed the protections they had. And they are vying that look, the gold is our data. And you know this, I know Treasury knows. The gold is our data. That's their dollars. And we just watched Elon Musk steal a whole bunch of it. Just walk out the door, walk into government, steal it, and walk out the door. And he's getting $8 million a day in federal government contracts. So we do need the spend, you know, how we spend our dollar strategy, but we also have to understand where the political economy is with corporations and understand unless they understand we have an ability to make it less desirable for business, and I'm being plain, and we work with all these corporations, it is going to even impact state and local strategies. I want to link it to your first part of your question. Because even what's happening in state and local races are being influenced by lies online. And yes, people are believing them. YouTube, about Latinos on the Latinos who are on YouTube who are getting Spanish language news, that's for half of them, that's their only news source. So if lies are on it.
I'm agree with you, but I'm going to jump in.
Let me just say, Melody, as you conclude this, we're going to move to the next question. So just go ahead and
we all got
real quick for
lots me. To say. Only thing that I'm going to get back to is what the average person can do is how you manage your money. We got to fight that fight, a lot of us that are in these positions. But what that average person can do is where are you shopping with your money? Spend your money. Yes.
And raise your voice about this corruption, though. I mean, that's the
I agree with that.
We actually have a petition on Meta now.
Right. And I'm saying there's institutional strategy.
It's a both.
And then there's an and.
Both hands.
It's an and. Yes. Okay. Yes.
Okay. Good morning, Reginald Benbow from Chicago. This is especially for Dr. Crenshaw. How can we apply the concept of intersectionality fit for purpose in 2025 and thinking about especially building intra-Black coalitions to combat things like the anti-immigrant attitudes that can hamper coalition building between Black Americans and those of Caribbean and African descent, as well as to combat homophobia and transphobia within Black communities?
Thank you for that question. The first combat move is to get intersectionality right. And so it has been subject to malignant disinformation. If you listen to the MAGA revolution, they would say that intersectionality is identity politics on steroids. Intersectionality creates a new pariah class. Intersectionality tells people that all they are is a bunch of identities. Intersectionality has never been about identity. It's been about how the structures in which we live disadvantage us based on who we are. And sometimes we're in a position where we are disadvantaged by multiple systems of subordination. So it's not that we're born intersectional subjects. We become subject to intersectional exclusion and subordination based on the society that we live in. So the first thing is just getting that right. Once we get that right, then it becomes easier to tell people, look, anti-Blackness is playing out both in the attack on immigrants as well as on the attack on naturalized American citizens. We need to come together because we know that what happens to you will happen to us. We know that the power that's being given to federal officials just to take us off the streets, as Melanie says, is eventually going to happen to us as well. There's nothing that happens to any particular group in this society that's not eventually going to happen to others. And many times anti-Blackness is at the core of it. So that is just one example of how we build off of intersectionality. But the other thing is, and I'm glad you said intra-group issues, because one of the things that I do worry about when we acknowledge the fact that our voting behavior is now being more splintered, I think we don't often acknowledge that there are also some internal politics to that that are about intersectionality. So I'm the last person to say that this last election was determined, you know, by us. We Black voters voted for the pro-democracy candidate more than anybody else. That was really, really important.
It's also true that there are divisions that intersectionality probably has something to say about. 92% of black women got democracy right. We got it
and
right.
And usually do.
In 80, right? And 87% of black men get it right. Usually when you get an A grade, or A minus grade, the teacher says, okay, these are the people we want to emulate. Tell us how you were able to figure out what the pro-democracy vote was, what the pro-future vote was. Tell us how you got it right. Instead, we got sent to detention. Nobody talks about why the 92% and the 87% got it right. And they're telling us that we didn't see what we saw. They're telling us, who are you going to believe? Us or your lying eyes? We knew how much racism and misogyny played a role in that election. We knew and we saw it. And they're telling us it's not real. That is an intersectional moment because it was racism mixed with sexism. And a lot of our pundits are not able to identify that. So it's both intersectionality inside. We've got to call those who, you know, basically said, I don't want no woman as a president, even though she's a woman who looks like me. We got to call that out because that's real. We got to call out the fact we've done some research that suggested that there is a lowered concern about the state of race relations in this country, and it is intergenerational. More than half of the young people that we actually talked to said they were kind of okay with the state of race relations. I think that's partly because they're receiving race relations over this. And not necessarily in that reality. And lastly, we have sort of gender in our broader community that we have to do.
All right, let me move.
One practical thing, though, policing. Because they're using city police to do things that they shouldn't be doing. So the link between how black people are experiencing policing and what ICE is doing is a link opportunity.
This side, yes.
Hello, my name is Stacey D. Brown. I am from Texas. My question has to do with intergenerational work and transference of power within our organizations. We had at least three elected officials die in office that were above the age of 70. So how do we get rid of this, wait your turn, it's not your turn yet, and really empower, not just say that we're listening to the younger generations, but actually let them lead.
Mm. Well, I've lived long enough to know that some of that, they all gonna just die out, right? Just gonna die, right? And that's just fact. Right? The other part is because this young brother, the mayor, right? What I do see on a local level across this country, young people are running, right? Y'all have young professionals. How many young professionals in here, right? Right? Young professionals, right? You all, if you're not, I'm sure, and I know you do because I was there when it started. That's how long I've been around the Urban League, right? When you started young professionals, I was a young professional, right? I'm no longer that, right? But that's where it starts. And you organize yourselves to make sure that that's a part of your overall strategy as young professionals, is to do that. And I think that's part of it, right? You think about the fact that you almost had a woman and a South Asian woman become president of the United States, right? In the scheme of things, she was pretty young running for that position. So I know that sometimes you just have to bulldoze your way through. Right, you have to bulldoze your way through, but you also organize amongst yourselves as leaders because you're already those leaders, right? The people who got elected, when you think about black people getting elected, they got elected young, and then there were people who didn't want them. There were people in the civil rights movement who didn't. I spent a lot of years in Atlanta politics. Anybody in Atlanta, Nancy Flake in here, right? Understanding that you had to force your way through, right? When John Lewis became congressperson, he was a relatively young, and the establishment didn't want John Lewis. I was there. I was living in Atlanta. And we were the rabble rousers that said, we're going to put him in office. And he was able to serve. So some of it is you just got to ram your way through, baby.
And let's be clear. Let's be clear. That's not new. Yeah. Historically, that has always happened. And to your point, one time we were all the young people coming up. We had to either wait for them to die out or move them aside. And that's really going to be upon you. Whether you want to, your group,
decide we're going to wait for them to die off, or we're going to say, no, enough is enough, and we're going to get a little louder and engage ourselves.
But our generation has to be significantly better at building the network. Mm-hmm. We do. Yeah. We are not doing enough. And unless we're building the network of relationships, we are not helping that next generation take.
And on that note, let me say something about what I think the role of leaders, existing leaders, can do in building that network. One of the things that my organization, the African American Policy Forum, is doing actually in 2 days is building community with Representative Justin Jones. He is the tremendous representative in Tennessee. We've gone there now 2 years in a row to do summer school, and summer school built off of Mississippi Freedom Summer, where young people actually went into communities and built community with them. We know that we need to be what Justin says. We need to go to the tip of the spear. If we want to know what Project 2025 is going to look like across the country, we need to be in places like Tennessee, where that was the laboratory for the destruction of inclusion, destruction of democracy. And what we're doing when we're going there is building cross-generational relationships. We bring the Freedom Riders into conversation with 18-year-olds so they can share the common history. We're bringing people in who will help people learn how to podcast, how to do reports, how to use social media for political ends. And we're bringing people who've been thinking about fascism from a racial perspective into conversation with organizations, with leaders, and others who are seeing it playing out on the ground. So we have to curate these spaces where we can share our common wisdom and bring people in who have the capacity to be the leaders of the next generation.
Yeah, sharing wisdom cross-generationally is one thing. Conceding power cross-generationally is another thing. And we should note that human nature is human nature. A boss don't want to give up being a boss often.
I want somebody to take this, please.
Okay, that part.
Yes.
That part.
Good morning. Desiree Calaguay. I'm from the greater Cleveland area, and I work between D.C. and here as an educator, coordinator, instructor, teacher, and so on. And I wanted to also address the networking before I pose my question to you. Kudos to Urban League of Greater Cleveland. They do a lot with the youth and networking here. So. And also the Cleveland City Club, oldest free speech organization in the country. They have no fear to address everybody and bring everybody to the table. And they have built up a mighty youth forum. It is extremely extensive and includes thousands. So the work is there, but much more work has to be done. But my question pertains to education. Let's keep this quote in mind before I pose it. Francis Bacon said, knowledge is power. Mm-hmm. And since Napoleon Bonaparte's time of the introduction of public schooling, that's another analysis in itself with the current administration, as well as literacy, it is a common good for all to receive an education. So this is the predicament that we have, and I welcome a recommendation on strategies. We have teachers, counselors, etc. They are instilled with fear as to what they're permitted to address and not address. They are also given strict directives of what to ban. They also are dealing with 30, 40 children in a classroom without an intervention specialist, with 50% IEPs and so on. And we do have, and I need to point this out.
I need you to get to your question.
Okay, sorry. We do have key individuals in executive administration and companies and so on that are doing the work, and they've been doing the work since the civil rights movement. But we need more, and also the other layering of management. What are the next strategies? What are the next steps in terms of motivating those individuals and motivating more people and more sponsors and more corporations and nonprofits?
Two parents went to a school board and got books banned. Two. Mm-hmm. How much power do we have? How many people in this room is a parent? How many? How many of us are going to school board meetings and making demands? Thank you. When we specifically organize
to use that power that is outside the building because our kids are inside, it doesn't even take that many of us, which should tell us how much power we have. And so I just want to say that as a very practical, knowing we're out of time, but we can do that now.
Yeah, how many people have governor's races next year in your state, right? State legislative races in your state, right? So that's, focus on that, or even this year, right? But focus on those. It's very, very good. Virginia, New Jersey, you have a governor's race. So Ohio has a governor's race this year?
Yeah.
Right, South Carolina. So where?
Florida,
Lord, yeah, our home state, Jesus. But it's an opportunity, it's an opportunity. Because really, those who believe in all children having an opportunity, raise your hand. We got the power, she keeps saying. We got the power. We just have to use it. But we have to use it because of what's happening in the public. My mother was a public school teacher in Florida, right? And understanding that dynamic as a child of a public school teacher where I had to go to school with her. Lord have mercy, right? That was a whole other thing. But that's the reality. Politics is what's affecting all the things that you talked about, what the teacher's able to do. But we know there's things that are happening on a federal level. That's a whole other issue. But I also remind people when it comes to them dismantling the public Department of Education, which is a real thing that the Supreme Court just said, is that the Department of Education was created. How many people thought it was created in the 60s? How many people? How many people know it was created by Jimmy Carter? How many people just didn't know, right? Most of us, right? So the reality is, as we're dealing with this fight, we also have to deal with what it is. And I'm going to say this to everybody, and really, really quickly, is that you all are first responders, many of you are. You are dealing with direct services. A lot of what we have, and if I'm going to say anything else today, is we know that we got to get ready. If they're dealing with that child, that family that has to find preschool for their kids, we're going to have to figure a way to create that. We got to actually going to have to fill the gap in some of these cases where it's going to take a while to deal with the impact. And I know that the Urban League, I thank you in advance for all, everything else you're going to have to do. We're the affiliates. I can't see with the lights, right? The heads of the Urban League local affiliates. Where are y'all at? I know y'all in here. Yeah, all over, right? You are going to have to fill that. We all going to have to help fill those
so
gaps.
So as you can see, she is no longer shy on stage. but let me say this.
Sorry.
As we literally have 3 minutes. I'd like to say thank you to all three of you, genuinely. Because as Melanie suggested, I've been out here a long time. It was all black when I started. And I can say I've watched... and gotten to know two of you well, but certainly watched all three from a distance and sometimes in close quarters fight the good fight. So we want to thank you for that. It can sometimes get long and tedious and thankless at times, but we appreciate that you are on the front lines. And I think we have to understand in forums like this, often I've heard people suggest that, well, they didn't give me an answer. Well, the answer cannot be found in an hour forum. What these forums are about is to kind of spark you to move. And I think Melanie said in the beginning, you really are the answer. And so we hope that this has motivated you a bit. So let me do some business here before we move to the next panel.
Well, before you do business, please let's thank Ed Gore.
Yes, that's fine.
And not just for moderating, but for being a voice out here that we need.
Unapologetically.
I appreciate that.